Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, author, and journalist Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our third look at the life and crimes of Jeffrey Dahmer. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast. If you'd like to help the show out, there's a couple ways you can do this. First and foremost, you can go to your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, just like my first two Patreon members, Chandler and Anthony, did. Alright, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair. Kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. When we left off last time, Jeffrey Dahmer was living with his grandmother, and he had resumed killing. It is now the mid-1980s. He has begun the process of holding on to his victims' skulls, something that would become part of his modus operandi, although, as you're going to see in this episode, with each subsequent killing, Dahmer, who has already dehumanized his victims within his own mind, really starts to... In the last episode, we had discussed an individual that Dahmer had met at one of the gay clubs, who had gone home with Dahmer only to awaken a few days later inside of a hospital with no recollection of how he had gotten there, or how he had possibly ended up in a field. This man later discovered that there were marks on the sides of his neck and that his underwear was turned inside out. This individual, Ronald Flowers, pressed charges against Jeffrey Dahmer on April 5th, 1988, after leading authorities to Dahmer's grandmother's house. Dahmer disputed the allegations, stating that the two of them had gone back to his grandmother's house, Flowers had drunk too much, and Dahmer had placed him on a bus, after which point Dahmer knew nothing more of Flowers' disposition. Because of all of this, Dahmer's parents decide that he is no longer fit to live with his grandmother. This is after Dahmer's grandmother complains to her son Lionel about Dahmer's drinking, the fact that he is bringing young men back to her house late at night while she is sleeping, and also because she has noticed strange smells in both the basement and in the garage. As this is going on, as Dahmer is looking for a place to live, his father brings Jeffrey to a doctor to be treated for his alcoholism. Dahmer stays with this doctor for 4 sessions, however, nothing changes. A few months after the incident with Ronald Flowers, Dahmer again encounters the man at the same gay bar that he had first met him at. Flowers goes up to Dahmer and, in his own words, asked him if he remembered him. Dahmer feigns ignorance, but does say that if Flowers wants to, he can come back to his grandmother's house for a coffee. The man then nearly gets into a fist fight with Jeffrey Dahmer. However, he is restrained by his companions that night. Later on in the evening, as he's leaving the club, Flowers sees Dahmer getting into a cab with an unnamed African-American man, and he screams out across the street that the man should not go with Dahmer, as Dahmer is crazy. According to Flowers, this was enough to dissuade the man from going with Dahmer, and the individual instead got out of the cab and walked off into the night. Dahmer eventually gets a one-room apartment at 808 North 24th Street, and it's here that he buys the first part of what is eventually, in his mind, going to become his altar, or the temple of bones that Jeffrey Dahmer dreams of building. It is a long black table with a Griffith on either end of it. Moving into this apartment, Dahmer brings the skull of Richard Guerrero with him. All of this Dahmer paid for with the job that he continued to hold at the Ambrosia Chocolate Factory. The first few years Dahmer was working there, his progress reports noted that he was pretty much a model employee and spoke of him in rather glowing terms, although eventually, as Dahmer's mania begins to progress and spiral, this is going to change, and the company is going to look at him as more of a detriment than an asset. In September of 1988, Jeffrey Dahmer has another encounter with law enforcement. This is while he's living at the apartment on 24th Street. Dahmer meets a young child, a 13-year-old, and entices the youth back to his apartment to pose for naked pictures in exchange for money. This is around 3:30 in the afternoon on Monday, September 26th. The individual, Samsak Syntha Samophone, and it would later emerge that Dahmer had been approaching others on this day, going up to them and telling them that he had just purchased a new camera that he wanted to try out. This is not out of the ordinary for a sexual sadist of Jeffrey Dahmer's type. If you'll recall the series we did on Rodney Alcala, this was the ruse that he used in order to lure young women into his presence and away from the public. Samsak later stated, quote, "I thought he was nice and just wanted to try out his new camera." Once in the apartment, Dahmer gets a camera out and begins to give the young boy instructions. After taking some photographs, they go into the kitchen where Dahmer and the child share a cup of coffee, although Dahmer insists that Samsak drink the majority of the cup. We know that Dahmer attempted to fondle the young boy after this, and that the boy resisted letting Jeffrey know that it was time for him to leave, and that Dahmer insisted the young boy come and sit next to him, at which point Dahmer is reported to have said, quote, "I want to hear your stomach," at which point he placed his head against Samak's stomach and began to kiss and lick it. Samak jumped up, grabs his stuff, and makes for the door. Jeffrey is reported to have told the child not to tell anyone while offering him his $50. Samsak stated that as he made his way back to his parents' house, he began to feel extremely tired and was nearly unable to stand by the time he reached the front door. A few hours after this, the child's father found him unconscious and was unable to wake him up. The family brings Samsak to the hospital, where it was said that the boy was suffering from a drug overdose. At this point in time, the police are contacted, and Samsak Synthesunophone tells them exactly what had happened to him earlier that day. After leaving the hospital at around 10:30 p.m., he leads police to Dahmer's apartment on 24th Street. Finding that the individual who lived there, Jeffrey Dahmer, was not home, police head to the Ambrosia Chocolate Factory. Dahmer is then arrested for second-degree sexual assault and enticing a minor for immoral purposes. According to Jeffrey, he was more embarrassed over having been outed as being gay at work than he was over the fact of being arrested. We know that he spent at least 6 days in jail after this arrest. Amazingly, Dahmer is not fired for this particular offense, But one interesting thing that occurs because of it is the fact that Jeffrey Dahmer tells his father, finally, that he is gay. According to Dahmer, quote, "He asked me if I was gay, and I told him yes, and he accepted it fairly well. He didn't get upset or anything about it. He just acted surprised and wondered why I'd never told him before, and I said I didn't tell him because I was embarrassed." Dahmer's father ends up hiring a lawyer who sends Jeffrey for a series of psychological evaluations. He's diagnosed as being a schizophrenic type, but also of being a loner, extremely secretive and crafty. One of the psychologists notes that there is no question that Mr. Dahmer is in need of long-term psychological treatment. Dahmer's probation officer for his earlier conviction for exposure sends him for another psychological evaluation, where it is found that he is, quote, "resistant and evasive, showing irritation, anger, agitation, and answering in monosyllables, suspicious of the motives of others, impulsive, and highly unlikely to tolerate frustration of self-gratification," while also finding that Dahmer is unhappy with his lack of accomplishments, manipulative, and self-centered. The psychologist went on to further state that Dahmer would not show others the depth, severity, or extent of his pathology, while noting that others would not take his behaviors as seriously as they should. In conclusion, this doctor wrote that Jeffrey Dahmer was, quote, "a seriously disturbed young man with a mixed personality disorder. The pressure he perceives seems to be increasing, and he must be considered impulsive and dangerous." Dahmer's probation officer stated that while Dahmer was not psychotic, it would not take much to push him to that point, and it was her belief that alcohol served this purpose of making Dahmer psychotic. While all of this is going on, the family convenes yet again, and Dahmer moves back in with his grandmother. On January 30th of 1989, Jeffrey Dahmer pleads guilty to the charge of second-degree sexual assault and of enticing a child for immoral purposes, claiming that he was unaware there were any drugs inside of the coffee cup that the child drank from, as he had used it earlier himself and did not notice the residue inside of it. Jeffrey also claims that he is aghast to discover that the boy is only 13 years of age. The judge does not immediately sentence Jeffrey to any sort of punishment, instead stating that he needs time to consider the actions of Jeffrey Dahmer and his prior criminal history before doing so. Jeffrey is eventually going to be sentenced to 1 year in the House of Corrections, where he's going to be involved in a work release program that will allow him to leave the facility 6 days a week for his job at the Ambrosia Chocolate Factory. And in preparation for this, Dahmer takes a 10-day leave of absence from work, getting all of his affairs into order. This is over the period of time in 1989 where Easter falls. On Easter Sunday, which would be March 25th of 1989, Jeffrey Dahmer feels the need for a sexual release. We know that on that night, Dahmer goes out. He goes to numerous bars, although, according to him, he did not encounter anyone for the majority of the night until he went to a bar called La Cage, which is located on 2nd in National in Milwaukee. To quote Dahmer, I was walking towards the entrance. I wasn't planning on meeting anyone or going out with anyone, and this nice-looking black guy starts talking to me, just out of the blue. This was a 24-year-old man by the name of Anthony Sears. According to Dahmer, he and Sears then went back to his grandmother's house, being driven by a friend of Sears named Jeff Connor. According to Connor, he had serious reservations as he dropped the two of them off, stating that Dahmer went and stood across the street while Sears and Connors spoke amongst one another. Connor stated that he made his friend promise him that he would call him the moment that Sears was done with his encounter with Jeffrey. According to Dahmer, after going into his grandmother's house around 3 a.m., he and Sears sat in the kitchen for a period of time before going upstairs into Jeffrey's bedroom, where they began to fool around. He stated that oral sex was performed. Jeffrey said that he asked Sears how long he could stay, and that if Sears could return after he had left. He said that Anthony Sears told him that he would not be able to stay too long, and that after he left, it was doubtful whether or not he would return. At this point, according to Jeffrey, he was feeling rejected, so he goes down into the kitchen and makes Anthony Sears a drink of coffee, Bailey's Irish cream, and sleeping pills. After Anthony Sears falls asleep, Jeffrey lays with him for a while before strangling him to death. Later that morning, his grandmother wakes up. Jeffrey has breakfast with her and wishes her well as she prepares to head off to service at church for Easter Sunday. With his grandmother gone, Jeffrey then goes up into his bedroom and performs necrophilia on Anthony Sears' corpse, after which he drags Anthony's body into the bathroom and places it into the bathtub. Dahmer stated that he then decapitates Anthony's body, cuts off his genitals, and begins to flay him, placing the head and genitals as well as some pieces of skin into a separate bag, because, quote, unquote, him I like especially well. He then smashes the bones into a powder, disposing of the remains in the trash as he had done with his other victims. Jeffrey stated that the following day, Monday, he contacts a local taxidermist and learns that in order to preserve the parts he has saved, which include the flesh on the genitalia, he should use acetone. Dahmer then goes to a local hardware store, buys a 10-gallon bucket with a lid on it, as well as enough acetone to fill it. Jeffrey places Anthony Sears' head and genitals inside of this bucket, which is kept on the floor in his bedroom closet. Jeffrey purchases some makeup, which he uses on the genitals in order to make them look real. Jeffrey stated that after placing these items inside of the acetone, the head was still extremely lifelike, and he would hold it on occasion while masturbating, or using it as a sex toy to pleasure himself. Jeffrey would eventually scalp Anthony Sears' skull and use his scalp as a sexual stimulation device. Tony Sears' friends were immediately concerned come Easter morning when they didn't hear from him. His friend Jeff Connors went back to the street Jeffrey's grandmother looked on. However, as he did not know which house it was that his friend had got into, there was very little he could do. Instead, he reached out to mutual friends and told them that something was wrong. One of these friends went over to Anthony's apartment, and upon discovering that his animals had not been fed, immediately contacted the police. The police took a full police report, including a written physical description of the person that Connor knew only as Jeff from Chicago. However, this missing persons report ends up lying on file, and it does not appear that the police ever followed up on it in any way. As for Jeffrey Dahmer, his date for going into the Department of Corrections building is drawing ever closer, and realizing that he cannot leave the macabre items that he has kept of Anthony Sears at his grandmother's house inside of the footlocker that he has them stored in, Dahmer goes out and buys a small cosmetic case and places the head, which he said by this point was starting to shrivel slightly and look mummified, and the genitalia inside of this. He then brings these items with him to work and places them in his locker at the Ambrosia Chocolate Factory. During Thanksgiving of 1988, as he's serving his sentence at the Department of Corrections, Dahmer is allowed a 10-hour pass for Thanksgiving. He chooses not to go to his grandmother's home and instead goes to downtown Milwaukee, where he spends the night drinking and is known to have had at least one sexual encounter with a man that he met at one of the bars. Dahmer stated that it was he who ended up victimized at this point, coming to tied up above the man's bed, hog-tied, as he put it, while the man violated him with a candle. Dahmer said that he screamed loud enough that the man released him and he was able to escape. On March 2nd, 1990, Jeffrey Dahmer is released from the prison, this after serving 9 months. Some suspect that this release was a direct result of a letter that another prisoner had written posing as Jeffrey Dahmer, and which Jeffrey Dahmer had copied and mailed to the judge who had sentenced him. While others speculate that Dahmer was released at this point because an agent from the Department of Health and Human Services, whom Dahmer had met with numerous times while he was incarcerated, recommended him for early parole. Once out of prison, Jeffrey Dahmer is on 5 years of probation. According to his probation officer, at the very first meeting, Jeffrey told her that his real problem was his alcoholism, and that his alcoholism grew worse because he had no friends and instead chose to drink alone. We know that despite having been incarcerated, Dahmer did not change his ways in any noticeable manner. He immediately went and got a fresh prescription for sleeping pills, as well as another prescription 2 weeks after that first one from another doctor. Dahmer returns to his grandmother's house, bringing the remains of Anthony Sears with him. Although he's not going to be there long, Dahmer stays at his grandmother's house long enough to boil Anthony's skull to remove the flesh, and it's at this point that he actually scalps it and keeps the hair. Dahmer then spends an entire day looking for an apartment, which he finds at the Oxford Apartments on North 25th Street. For $300 a month, Jeffrey Dahmer rents a one-bedroom apartment in number 213. This $300 included everything from furnishing to utilities, with the exception of electrical. And it's inside of this apartment that the Jeffrey Dahmer most people think of when they hear his name really is born and begins to act out the darkest of dark fantasies that are hiding inside of his mind. Now, the section of Milwaukee that Dahmer lived to was akin almost to a demilitarized zone. It was a ghetto. Dahmer would later state that although he was one of the only white individuals to live in this area, it didn't bother him that much, as he had no plans on interacting with anyone in the neighborhood, nor did he mind the fact that it was crime-ridden or that drug-related crimes occurred on an almost continual basis. During his first few months within the apartment, Dahmer primarily busied himself between going to work and traveling to nearby Chicago, where he joined another bathhouse. We have no recorded incidents of him having drugged anyone while he was at any of these establishments. This is a break from the acts that he undertook when he was going to the bathhouses in Milwaukee, and shows that as a predator, he had learned as he progressed in his depraved activities, and now understood that that type of behavior would bring the unwanted attention of law enforcement to his front door. On May 20th of 1990, Jeffrey Dahmer encountered a male sex worker by the name of Raymond Smith, who went by the street name of Ray Bees. Smith was a 32-year-old African-American man who told any who asked him about his chosen career path as a male prostitute that he was not himself gay, but that he could earn a better living by doing this than he could if he were to hold a legitimate job. Dahmer stated that he met Smith at the 219 Tavern, at which point he offered him $50 to come home and have sex. Along the way, the taxi cab stopped so Dahmer could pick up cigarettes, with the two men arriving back at his home at roughly 3 a.m. When Smith informed Dahmer that for $50 he was only going to get a short ride, Dahmer asked if he would spend the night, to which Smith replied this would cost him a lot more money than $50. Dahmer told Smith that he would give him the rest of the money in the morning before heading into the kitchen and mixing Richard a drink laced with 7 crushed sleeping pills. Dahmer said that it took less than half an hour for Richard Smith to fall unconscious, at which point he straddled his body on the floor and strangled him to death. Dahmer said that he placed Smith's body on the table that he had purchased. This is the one with the Griffith statues on it, that he planned on using as part of his altar or temple. He said that he put Smith in various poses that he found to be attractive. It does not appear as though Dahmer did anything too heinous with his body on this first night. However, the next day, Dahmer went out and bought a Polaroid camera. Dahmer was content to simply masturbate over Richard's body. He stated that he never violated him in any form or fashion beyond taking his life and dismembering the body. Dahmer said that he dissected the man's body in the bathroom using an 80-gallon steel kettle drum to boil Richard's bones in a solution of water and Soilex. Dahmer's purpose in doing this was he intended to keep Richard Smith's skeleton intact. After rinsing off the bones and any bits of flesh that remained in the kitchen sink, Dahmer then went to bed. The following day, he bought a large freezer. However, according to Dahmer, he was dismayed when the skeleton simply fell apart, as without any tissue or muscles to hold it together, nothing was connecting the bones to one another. Dahmer stated that he went out and bought a large trash can, which he filled with an acid. Quote, I waited a week or two and they had all turned to slush at this time, which I scooped out with a smaller trash thing and poured it into the toilet and flushed it down. It was just all slush, black slush. However, as he had done with Anthony Sears, Dahmer saved Richard Smith's skull, painting it. After this, Dahmer's appetite was unfortunately nowhere near sated, as his cooling off period between murders is going to grow shorter and shorter from this point on. We know that roughly 2 weeks after he took the life of Richard Smith, Dahmer tried again after luring a man up to his apartment. However, on this occasion, Dahmer accidentally drank the drug-laced drink that he had prepared for his intended victim, and according to Dahmer, when he woke up the following morning, the man was gone. Number of items of clothing were missing, and the man had stolen $300 from his wallet. Dahmer said that he never reported this incident. However, he did say that he eventually told his parole officer that he had been robbed without giving too many details. It was noted during this point in time by both his parole officer as well as the psychologist that Dahmer was court-ordered to see, that there was a noticeable slipping of his personal hygiene and grooming habits. Dahmer had always been noted for being fastidiously neat. However, as the months progressed from his time moving into the Oxford apartments, he began to look more disheveled and unwashed. This is noteworthy as it's the first indication that something is going on in Dahmer's life which is causing him some form of duress. We know that many serial killers, when they have exterior stressors, are more apt to commit murder than they are when these stressors are not there. It's kind of a release valve for them, similar to an alcoholic taking a drink. Just like the alcoholic, the commission of these crimes adds further stress to the killer, so now they're more and more compelled to go out and commit further crimes, releasing that stress while at the same time compounding it exponentially. On June 23rd of 1990, there was a gay pride parade held in downtown Milwaukee. Said that this parade was fairly well attended. We know that Dahmer encountered a 27-year-old African-American man by the name of Edward Smith. We know from later accounts that Edward Smith had encountered Dahmer on at least one other occasion at the 219 Club, where friends saw him conversing with Jeffrey. They again encountered each other, this on the early morning hours of Sunday, June 24th, after this pride parade had taken place and the city's gay population was in a joyous mood. At the Phoenix Bar, Dahmer gets Smith back to his apartment in the normal fashion. He drugs and then strangles the man. Dahmer stated, however, that the photographs he took of Edward Smith's corpse were not acceptable to him, and he ends up destroying them. Dahmer places Eddie's skeleton inside of the freezer. However, after a few months, he learns that it's not going to dry out properly. He ends up acidifying it. At some point during the days after taking Eddie's life, Dahmer places the man's skull into the oven for an hour. However, this proved disastrous as the skull began to explode inside of the oven. Much like the skeleton, Dahmer ends up putting the skull into an acid bath. Of this murder, Dahmer would later state that he felt awful about having taken Edward Smith's life, not because he had taken the man's life, but because he had not been able to keep anything from this momentous occasion, i.e., there was no skull, there was no bones, nothing for him to remember the man by. Unlike a lot of Dahmer's victims, Eddie's friends and family would go to the gay bars they knew Eddie had frequented, holding pictures of him in an attempt to find out what had happened to Edward Smith. After all of this, Dahmer went about his life as normal, going through the cooling-off period, visiting with his probation officer and various counselors. We know that Dahmer ends up encountering a 15-year-old after the murder of Edward Smith, who agrees to go back to the apartment with him. Unlike other occasions, however, this individual ends up spending the night with Dahmer willingly, and Dahmer does not take his life. The young man tells Dahmer that they will meet again at 12. Dahmer is excited at the prospect, although he did state that since he was out of sleeping pills and had no more money, he had to find alternative methods to render the boy unconscious. When noon came and the boy did not appear, Dahmer assumed that he had been duped. However, later that evening, when Dahmer goes to the bars, he runs into this young man yet again, who tells him that there was a misunderstanding. He meant 12 midnight, not 12 noon. The boy goes back to Dahmer's home, where Dahmer photographs him, and while this young boy is lying face down on the bed, Dahmer hits him in the back of the head with a mallet. However, it does not kill the boy, and after a brief argument, Dahmer surprisingly lets the young man leave. A few minutes after this young boy shows back up at Dahmer's house. Dahmer lets him in, and the boy tells him that he needs money to catch a ride home. A fight breaks out between the two of them. Dahmer says, quote, "I guess I intended on strangling him, but he was too strong." And after a few minutes, when it became apparent that Dahmer would not be able to overpower the young man, he asked if he wanted to talk. Dahmer ends up getting the young boy to allow him to put his hands behind his back so Dahmer can tie them. Amazingly, this kid ends up surviving. Dahmer lets him leave at about 7 o'clock in the morning. Jeffrey later stated, "I just didn't have the ability to do him any harm. Why, I don't know." The young boy goes and informs the police as what has happened, and a false imprisonment report is filed. Unfortunately, the boy kept changing his story, leading the police to believe that the entire incident was either a lover's quarrel or that he was making the entire thing up. After this, Dahmer seems to have settled into his rather mundane existence, going to work, going home after work, having something to eat, possibly going out for a little while during the day, watching some television, drinking, and going to sleep before returning to work again. We know that he bought an aquarium during 1991 that he filled with triggerfish, a hobby that Jeffrey Dahmer found to be nearly therapeutic. After his arrest, Dahmer would say that it was the one thing that he missed, having this aquarium with the fish inside of it. Beyond that, he continued with his prowling when he was not at work, going out and attempting to solicit men to come back to the apartment with him. The police would eventually interview dozens and dozens of young men, some of whom would give testimony at Dahmer's trial concerning his approaching them, etc., and why they had turned him down. On September 2nd of 1990, as he was about to enter a bookstore, Jeffrey Dahmer encountered Ernest Marquez Miller, age 22. At 3 a.m., Dahmer offers Miller $50. They walk back to his apartment. Dahmer said that he lay on top of Miller, listening to the sounds of his stomach for a while, before attempting to perform oral sex on Miller, who informed Dahmer that this would cost him extra. Dahmer stated that he made Miller a drink. When Miller had fallen asleep, he began to molest the body. Jeffrey said that the biggest problem he had was the fact that he had only been able to give Miller 2 sleeping pills, and that this was not enough to keep the man asleep while he did everything that he wanted to him. So to counteract this, Dahmer gets the knife that he uses to dissect the bodies and slices Miller's carotid artery. Dahmer said that blood went everywhere, as naturally it would do. Dahmer then places Miller's body on the black altar and takes numerous photographs. Jeffrey stated he then placed the body inside of the bathtub, at which point he began to dismember it, talking to Miller's severed head after he had removed it, telling him that he was sorry that he had had to do this, but there was just no other way. Quote, "I separated the joints, the arm joints, the leg joints, and had to do 2 boilings. I think I used 4 boxes of Soilix for each one, put in the upper portion of the body and boiled that for about 2 hours, and then the lower portion for another 2 hours. The Soilix removes all the flesh, turns it into a jelly-like substance, and it just rinses off. Then I laid the clean bones in a light bleach solution, let them there for a day, and spread them out on either newspaper or cloth, and let them dry for about a week in the bedroom." This is the first known instance where Dahmer begins to store portions of the victim's body, the liver, the heart, lungs, sections of muscle from the torso and arms inside of his freezer. Dahmer said that he tried to reassemble Miller's skeleton using glue, but when that proved to not be practical, he simply placed all of the bones inside of a bottom dresser drawer and left them there for the time being. Dahmer also added Miller's skull, which was painted and lacquered with the teeth glued back in, to his growing collection, something that he kept out in his apartment, and which he later said he was not concerned about others finding, as they did not look real, and people would assume that they were Halloween decorations. Jeffrey Dahmer is going to end up eating a portion of Ernest Miller's body. This really was a way for Dahmer to keep his victim with him forever by placing a part of him inside of himself that he could then digest. He's not the only cannibalistic serial killer, but Jeffrey Dahmer is one of the few who openly talked about the things that he had done after his arrest. It was also a way for Jeffrey Dahmer to relive the crime and his time with the victim. Something that Jeffrey is going to do more and more of as the months progress, and he further spirals into the mania, the compulsion, which drives him to take the lives of others. And it is something that Dahmer is going to end up enjoying on one hand, while on the other, he is repulsed by his activities at the same time. We are going to end the episode at this point. I hope that you guys have enjoyed our third look at the life and crimes of Jeffrey Dahmer. Until next time, stay morbid!